I'm Melissa Bowman for CKMS News on 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. Thanks for tuning in to today's Waterloo Region Weekly Roundup. In this episode, I will once again take a look at some of the affordable housing issues that local municipalities are discussing. The Region of Waterloo Council was recently provided an update on where things currently stand with the closing of the 5 regional operated children's centers, so we'll take a look at that as well. Also, we know that communities that are racialized or marginalized have been impacted more deeply by this pandemic. I'll share an update from a recent Regional Council Public Health Board meeting that discussed this issue and some of the plans stemming from that meeting. Let's once again dive into the issue of housing in our region, a topic that seems to be a part of many council meeting discussions these days. If you recall, Regional Council finalized its 2021 budget earlier this year. That budget includes a plan to spend $20 million to create 500 affordable housing units over each of the next 2 years. That's about 10 times what the region typically creates. Some of those funds will be used this year to kickstart affordable housing units as quickly as possible. Also, in that same meeting, Council approved the creation of a 0.5% tax levy specifically for affordable housing, but that won't start until 2022, assuming Council moves forward with it at that time. Councillor Jim Erb proposed that special tax levy and said that for affordable housing, the essential structural foundation is guaranteed sustainable funding. That brings us to February's Regional Council Committee of the Whole meeting, where the Housing Policy Review was discussed. This review, according to the media release, will ensure that we plan for the right mix of housing types for over the next 30 years to support housing choice, aging-in-place opportunities, and improved affordability. The growth plan was also discussed at this meeting. It requires the region to establish targets for both affordable ownership and rental housing in alignment with the region's 10-year housing and homelessness plan. The plan was reviewed in 2020 and established an affordable housing target for Waterloo Region, which is 30% of all new residential development between 2019 and 2041 to be affordable for low and moderate income households. One method that may help the region achieve those targets is through inclusionary zoning, which allows municipal governments to mandate that new developments must have a minimum percentage of affordable housing included. However, that method is somewhat limited, as outlined by provincial rules stating numerous guidelines and regulations, such as what percentage can be mandated and that developments must be near major transit station areas. Cambridge, Kitchener, Waterloo, and the region are all in the process of evaluating the feasibility of inclusionary zoning. Regional Council was also updated on the Land Needs Assessment, which determines the amount of land required to accommodate population and employment growth forecasted by the province up to 2051. Clearly, each of these policies, plans, and reviews could impact housing affordability for years to come. During the review process and engagement with the regional official plan, numerous themes arose, including housing supply and affordability, the impacts of COVID-19 on land use planning, and community design and protection of cultural heritage resources. Staff say that, similar to their approach to climate action, these themes will be considered throughout the development and evaluation of the growth-related component of the Regional Official Plan Review, and appropriate policies will be included in the Regional Official Plan. The region is not the only local municipality engaged in policy review. At Kitchener's February 8th Community and Infrastructure Services Committee meeting, they discussed the Development Services Review. During the staff presentation, it was shared that the engagement review shows that the city is not engaging with a representative community voice yet, and more work needs to be done in this area. Regarding engagement around specific development proposals, staff mentioned that they are now moving to postcards instead of letters to send out to neighbors informing them of new developments in the area. Similar to the new development signs in front of upcoming builds, these postcards will be more visual, outlining the main details about the proposal with information about where to find out more details. Staff say that they are also doubling the mail-out area from what's required, the 120 meters, to 240 meters. Ward 9 Councillor Debbie Chapman asked staff if it is possible to increase the mail-out area to 800 meters in major transit station areas. Staff say that will increase costs a lot and may make it challenging to engage well with residents that would be most impacted by these new builds. Ward 10 Councillor Sarah Marsh also thinks there's value in expanding the radius. She says perhaps it makes sense for large developments, but not smaller low-rise builds. She also asks if those mailing costs could be passed on to the developers instead of the city footing the bill. Staff say that they are currently reviewing their existing fee structure and can look at that possibility. Councillor Singh had the following to say about the importance of the missing middle.
I'm hoping that this will be an equitable process for not just, you know, big developers or subdivisions. You know, myself and Councillor Ioannidis and a few others have continually talked about the missing middle. You know, when we talk about affordable housing, we're talking about, you know, additional rental units that can come online fast. And these are small development, triplexes, you know, fourplexes, fiveplexes, or even mid-rise development. Is it fair to say this development review just doesn't necessarily focus on the larger partners, but also retail investors that can fill that supply gap for us?
Councillor Debbie Chapman wonders how we can ensure that we don't only end up building high-rise condos.
I picked up this book this morning. It's called House Divided. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but I wanted to read one very short paragraph. And it says, removing red tape for development, as some propose, will merely result in more of the tall and sprawling varieties of housing we already have. And this approach will only make the type of housing supply we really need that much scarcer and more unaffordable. Already, mid-rise has become boutique. And two bedrooms starting in the $700,000 range, townhouses are luxury properties, fetching over $1 million. We need to be careful about what we ask for. So my question to staff is, what are we doing to ensure that with, you know, speeding up the process and making it more greater clarity and better understanding and all of these things that we're doing, what are we doing to ensure that we're not just setting the stage for more high buildings and the sorts of things that we're familiar with today.
Staff say that there's a real need for diversity of housing and that if we want to help with affordability, those types of housing can help, whereas single detached homes are the most expensive type of housing.
So I think we have to go back to the official plan and the provincial policy statement, which mandates a mix of developments. And so, you know, we need to be cognizant of that as we implement projects. But the other caution I would say as well is ground-oriented housing tends to be the most expensive housing as well. So detached housing is the most expensive. And there was an article just this past week that the average price of a detached house in Waterloo region is now over $800,000. You know, a lot of entry-level apartment style dwellings, the purchase price is in the low $300,000 range. And so part of the intent of the provincial policy statement is to provide a range of types of units and developments for people that have different values or different life circumstances to go through. And so the scope of this review isn't about looking at the types of housing. We were, you know, mandated to look at a development services review to focus on our site plan approval process and improving clarity and the process flow for that, as well as the community engagement component to improve the understanding and engagement around this.
Ward 1 Councillor Scott Davey reminds Council that if we are to protect the countryside line, we must be open to intensifying and to build up so we don't have to build out.
I just did want to comment briefly, if I could, on the idea of or the notion that's been raised about the type of housing that we need. And I just think it can't go without saying that, you know, we're all somewhere along the line, we're all going to fall in that spectrum between building up and intense development. And the flip side of that equation is urban sprawl in the countryside line. And I know all of us are going to be in slightly different spots in that spectrum, but we have to be cognizant that that's the real risk that we run when we, you know, if we rail against one or the other.
That concluded the Community and Infrastructure Services Committee meeting. However, Kitchener still had more housing discussions ahead. Later that same day, the Planning and Strategic Initiatives Committee met to discuss a proposed development on Mill Street by Polo Corp, who recently completed the Barra on Queen development. This proposal ranges in height from three-story townhomes fronting on Mill Street up to 12 stories closer to the Iron Horse Trail. Some of the concerns staff heard from residents about this proposal include heritage concerns, traffic, and urban design, mostly around height and size. Some of the actions taken in response to those concerns, as outlined in the staff report, include a neighborhood information meeting, the formation of a working group, and the inclusion of 5 affordable homes in the development. Polo Corp staff shared a bit about the project, and then the floor was open for public delegations. The first delegation to speak was Alex Petrovic from the Social Development Center, and she said that it must always be about the people. She states that there are thousands of underserved residents and references work that the Social Development Center is doing, which maps displacement. They have already mapped 120 locations, and Alex has concerns about the 12 households being displaced through this project. That's because this project would demolish 6 existing homes, 19 to 41 Mill Street, several of which provide housing in the affordable range. In order to get to the current design, Polo Corp met with a small working group of neighboring residents. I have not seen this approach before, but several members of that working group spoke at this public input session, and while most would still like to see some changes to the proposed design, they all spoke to the value of the working group approach. Jane Peller was one of the working group members and is a resident of Schneider Creek neighborhood. She says there's real value in working groups like these to create a better design that reflects collective goals.
These working groups are great ways to work together, planners, developers, and community, to produce developments that hopefully contribute positively to neighborhoods. And even if those groups end up not agreeing on some elements, they certainly can make significant changes. And the combined efforts often achieve better designs that helps meet some of our collective goals. This working group, as you heard, met about 3 times, and then we were abruptly concluded because of COVID. So this left the group feeling like we were not yet finished, that we had still matters to discuss.
Kevin White spoke next on behalf of Waterloo Region Yes in My Backyard. Kevin said that there continues to be a growing demand for housing, and not intensifying actually leads to even more pressures on existing housing, often raising costs of housing.
Tonight I am presenting on behalf of WRYMBY, Waterloo Region Yes in My Backyard, an organization that strives to welcome more neighbors into our community by saying yes to more housing. The proposed construction certainly has appealing qualities, not the least of which is the creation of affordable housing units, as there is demand for thousands of such units in the region. There are also associated benefits of creating a more environmentally responsible city in terms of density that surely weigh in the decision to proceed with such a plan. WRYMBY is pleased to support endeavors that increase the supply of housing. The greater the availability of housing, the more people that can be housed, and the more downward pressure we are likely to put on the overall cost of housing, not to mention corollary benefits such as helping to create a more walkable city and so on. However, there are concerns beyond simply supporting a project because it increases the supply of housing. We believe that the issues of tenant and resident displacement require respect, dignity, and justice. This cannot be done unilaterally and must be a solution that satisfies those being displaced as much as possible, and therefore requires community input and resources from the various parties involved to determine an appropriate procedure.
Former Ward 9 Councillor Frank Etherington spoke against this proposal and said that he's tired of the city encouraging resident engagement only to be ignored.
You'll be delighted to hear that I'm going to keep this short because, like others living in those older communities, I've become very jaded. I've made the same arguments numerous times to a local government that, in my opinion, is often hypocritical, putting development interests and profits way ahead of residential priorities.
Current Ward 9 Councillor Debbie Chapman says that there has been a tsunami of development in the core. She's left with optimism and dismay about this particular proposal.
There's been a tsunami of new development in Ward 9 over the past 2 years, and the feedback I have received regarding this site has been extraordinary. I've watched and participated in the process with both optimism and dismay. First, the dismay. What makes this different from most development projects of this size is that it is plunk in the middle of an established neighborhood. The fear I have of approving this proposed development is that it sets a precedent for future developments in established neighborhoods around the city. What makes me optimistic are two things. One is the fact that the working group is willing and happy to sit down with the developer and staff to continue the discussion. The second is, I guess there are three, because I was also encouraged to hear Joseph Pupulo say that he'd be willing to carry on the dialogue as well. The third item is that there is a successful precedent for this approach. And that was thanks to the formation of a working group and negotiation, Strasbourg Road development that we heard about at the Committee of and Infrastructure Services Committee meeting this morning, started out as a proposal to build three 15-story towers with 500 units. It was then reduced to two 12-story buildings with 288 units, and finally reduced to stacked townhouses with 200 units. All of these things give me great optimism.
Ward 2 Councillor Dave Schneider says that we need to intensify and do it responsibly. This proposal is near green space, transit, and other important amenities, which is good.
We're in a situation where we have a transit system built. We have amenities nearby. We have a trail nearby. You know, we can argue and discuss about the density of this project, but we do need to intensify. We want to do that responsibly.
Ward 3 Councillor John Gazzola says that the developer is entitled to make a profit, but the community is also entitled to maintain their community.
And I think one of the last speakers really made a point that hit home with me, and it's a point that we seem to forget too often. And that point was that we not only have the responsibility to grow the city, but also to maintain the character of the city. And I think we spend too much of our time being interested in growing our city so that we can get closer and closer to Toronto. But in so doing that, we lose the character of our neighborhoods.
It's recommended that this motion is deferred. Councillor Sarah Marsh is supportive of that deferral. She wants to ensure low-rise residential neighborhoods are protected, even in major transit station areas, which are the areas within an 800-meter radius of ION stops, and they have been targeted for intensification.
Low-rise neighborhoods need to be protected, even in the major transit station areas. We have our secondary plans that are being developed for a reason, and that is because we have put the LRT, the community has the LRT route that goes smack dab through the middle of a bunch of very established low-rise residential neighborhoods. And so there is a conflict there that we need to grapple with. And 12 stories with a huge footprint that expands well beyond 50% of the footprint of the actual property is not an appropriate use in a low-rise residential neighborhood.
The deferral passes unanimously. This issue will come back to committee on March 8th and then to council for final approval 2 weeks after that. That's it for my housing updates this week. So let's move on to the issue of the region closing its 5 children's centers. This is the first update to regional council on the plan since deciding in December to close the centers. There is no motion on this piece. It is simply an update for information. Staff say that they know that parts of the system are not working well and specifically mention limited access to childcare in some parts of the region, widely varying quality, long wait lists, and limited options for parents on shift work. Staff are looking at plans for community and parent engagement, which will begin with a survey in the next month or so. Once they receive that feedback, staff will be able to finalize priorities for the plan, but it will likely focus on improving affordability, quality, access, and equity and inclusion for Indigenous and racialized families who have traditionally had less access to childcare. There will be $1 million available this year on a grant basis to support centers with COVID-related costs, such as replacing materials, sick time for staff, and support for parent fees. Staff note that enrollment is still lower than usual across the system, with before and after school care reporting extremely low enrollment. It's also noted that there are 5 new child care centers scheduled to open locally in the next year or two. Staff conclude the presentation by saying,
"We know how important licensed quality child care is to children and families and to the economy in Waterloo Region, and we know there are things about the current system that really are not working for families. We're very interested to hear more from the community about key priorities for the future to make the system more equitable and responsive to families' needs. And I look forward to sharing updates with you further in the coming months."
As I mentioned, there was no action needed for that item, so that concludes that update. But let's stick with the region for our next item as well, which is a public health meeting which was held on January 26th that looked at the impact of COVID on racialized communities. There were 2 delegations who spoke to this. First up was Ruth Cameron, who is the Executive Director of AQUA, the AIDS Committee of Cambridge, Kitchener, Waterloo, and area. Ruth outlined the issues facing the community and the lack of response to date.
And what I want to do today is to discuss some concerns I have related to some marked, entrenched, and unaddressed disparities with regards to our local COVID-19 response. In April of 2020, the ACB network called on the region to mandate the collection of race-based data. And at that time, it was communicated that the region would be following the provincial response and not engaging in the collection of race-based data. Subsequent to that decision, in the summer, when local communities gathered to a demonstration, what happened was that there were several comments made in media that inadvertently connected the march to not yet apparent predicted surges in COVID-19 transmissions, which never did play out. Subsequent to that, when data was collected that showed that we had, despite only being 2.9% of the population, that Black communities were 10.9% of the COVID cases in Waterloo Region, the remark was made that there wasn't enough data at the time to warrant action. Race is not real. Race is socially constructed, but structural racism creates great health disparities.
Lang Nakube spoke next, echoing some of the previous comments. She speaks to the unique challenges faced by Black and Indigenous communities by the current health system.
Presently, we are a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, and this past year has extraordinarily exemplified some of the unique challenges that are faced by Black and Indigenous communities within our current health system. So in Waterloo Region, health officials were made aware by community members that COVID-19 is not an equal opportunity virus. So we know that our healthcare system, as well as our social infrastructures, drive marginalized communities to be disproportionately affected and to be underrepresented and to be ignored in the administration of intervention mechanisms. When data was produced showing the disproportionality of COVID-19 in racialized communities within the region, there was no subsequent strategy to address the specific ways that the virus was being transmitted in these areas. So a system has been created of continued neglect of racialized communities. And as of right now, they don't prioritize our health needs. They don't collect information on how we're impacted. And if the information is collected, if the information is present and the data is there, it's still not utilized. It absolutely cannot and should not be left up to our communities to have to build trust with a public health system that continues time and time again to harm us. We are tired of having to save ourselves.
Bruce Lochner, the region's CAO, agrees that there is not a lot of trust in systems and says it is important for this work to be community-led.
Also, the points that were made, by the delegation and others is there's not a lot of trust in systems. And again, going back to health, even where we do have relationships, there's hesitancy sometimes, there is mistrust. I lived in that system where the health system is not always a welcoming space like any system. And that's where discussions need to happen community-led.
Since that meeting, several pop-up COVID testing dates have been announced for several neighborhoods, including Kingsdale and Victoria Hills. And that concludes this episode of the Weekly Roundup, a program that is part of the Local Journalism Initiative grant program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can find out more about that initiative, as well as all of the CKMS programming at Radio Waterloo. Also, feel free to continue this conversation. You can find me on Twitter at M2Bowman. Thanks for listening.